the show, boys and girls. This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach. I hope this finds you well. It must be Saturday morning because it's time for It's Your Money. And I'm your host. I'm joined this morning by Deb Seward. Hey, Deb, how are you doing today?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Deb's going to help me get through a module of coaching today called The History of Investing. Now, if you're a first-time listener, It's Your Money airs every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. It's a syndicated radio show designed to pull back the curtain on the financial services industry and expose the truth about money and investing. And you guys are in for a real treat this morning, because talk about pulling back the curtain. Not only are we going to pull back the curtain, but we're going to tell you where the curtain was made. I mean, it's we're going to go into the history of investing. We're going to take you all the way back to 1776, where it really kind of began. And I've asked Deb to be a part of this because this is an exciting module. I love doing this one, and Deb's going to help me. But let me go ahead and set it up, and then Deb will just chime in here and there. By the way, Deb works in our office, Financial Abundance. She's fairly new and is doing a lot of support functions right now and so on. And so she's starting to get the hang of an academic approach to investing coming from traditional planning, right?
Right. It's really opened my eyes.
And this is someone 30 years in the business, which is interesting. But the history of investing, that's what we're going to talk about today. You do not want to miss any of this show. And if you do, you can always go to iTunes and listen to it, or financialabundanceinc.com. That's financialabundanceinc.com. And you can listen to our shows. You can go to WJC-TV, where I'm the NBC investor coach, and check out some video coaching on their site under the It's Your Money tab. With the commercials behind us, let's get focused on the history of investing. To begin our examination of history of investing, we need to go back to 1776, the year of our Declaration of Independence, and transport ourselves across the Atlantic Ocean to Scotland, which where your heritage lies, right?
Yeah, my maiden name, McCartney.
McCartney, okay. And, of course, there was a man who lived there named Adam Smith. Most of us are familiar with Adam Smith now. And if you remember the environment in which he lived in, countries had been ruled by monarchies for thousands of years, and the monarchies basically made up the rules, made up all the laws, set all the prices, and really determined property ownership, right? They really...
Yeah, you had to almost have one of the monarchs allow you to give you properties. That's the only way you could own land at that time.
Or be part of the family, I guess, right? So when Adam Smith postulated that government should not set prices, he was on the fringe. He was on the cutting edge. He would be considered a, what do they call him? Heretic, I guess, right? Would that be what it would be called, a heretic?
Yeah, or very forward-thinking.
Yeah. So what we want to do is take you through a timeline from 1776 up to present day and really give you all the studies and the acumen. Remember, we believe in an academic, scientific approach to investing. We don't believe that anyone out there has any insight that no one else has as it relates to the market and can consistently beat the market. So with that in mind, that's the reason we're going through the history of investing. Adam Smith wrestled with serious economic and political questions related to the best way to create wealth. Remember, Smith's thoughts and theories appeared in 1776 in the book, The Wealth of Nations. Have you ever read that book?
I have not.
It's hard to read, I have to tell you. I've read it about a year ago again, and it's just old English, so it's a little difficult to read. But what's incredible insight, common sense, you know. In 1792, the New York Stock Exchange was organized. Prior to that, investors would buy and sell stocks in coffee houses or pubs of the day. Buying stocks was viewed as speculation, since transactions were done while drinking coffee, beer, or some other libations. It was very speculative in nature.
Yeah, almost like a lottery.
Yeah, and it wasn't really respected at all. It was frowned on.
Right.
It was considered gambling, really. In 1847, though, this would be some 50-some-odd years later, a gentleman named Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. Now, I've never read that. Have you ever read it?
I have not read that one either.
Pieces of it. He basically said that free markets don't work, and it's not fair for some people who can create lots of wealth while other people suffer from lack of wealth. Boy, in a segue, this sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, socialism.
Boy, I don't know why that sounds familiar, but it sounds kind of familiar for some reason. Adam Smith said something quite simple, yet seemingly bizarre at the time, and that was this. You don't want a centralized monarchy to determine prices. Rather, the best way to create wealth is for people and governments to stop trying to mess with markets. In other words, markets work. Markets will set prices through supply and demand and determine the best prices for goods and services. Through this process, you could maximize the wealth of the economy far better than you could with any centralized committee. Smith said that this in 1776 when he made the first argument for what we now view as modern capitalism. And so for you young mindfuls of mush, you don't know what capitalism is. It's the opposite of communism, okay? The belief results in maximized freedoms, wealth, and the survivorship of economics. So really, what Adam Smith wanted to do was take and put the focus on supply and demand, innovation, entrepreneurism, capitalism.
Just freedom.
Freedom, yeah. And, of course, the opposite would be
Karl Marx.
The flip side, yeah.
Right, and he believed really that markets failed. So he thought it was best for society to set prices using a centralized mechanism and that government owns the means of production to help measure and ensure fairness of outcome and to achieve equality in the process. So socialism and communism really embraced this type of classless society, thinking that everyone should be equal in this with distribution of any goods or services that were received and kind of a dictatorial government.
And it takes away then, it takes away the whole wanting to strive and better yourself. And
entrepreneurship.
Reach on and be and go above. Now, go ahead.
What he failed to understand, this is Karl Marx now, what he failed to understand about human nature is that people in government responsible for achieving fairness and equality are not above human greed.
And that's
hello,
an issue.
Hello. Yeah.
You know, that's a big issue, Deb, on a side note. I've been saying to people from a political perspective, on the left, you've got the need and want for power, and on the right, you got the need and want for greed. And as a result, we're never going to have an unbiased leadership as a result, but that's another show for another day.
Well, therefore, the system would not be fair in that way, and as a matter of fact, it would be unfair to those people who were truly creating the wealth because that wealth would be confiscated by the government and redistributed to others, and that's happening.
Well, yeah, and we see the results of socialism and communism, and they don't work. Why is the, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine last night over dinner, why is it that the United States, what is the American dream? What makes us different? And to me, very simply, it's our rugged individualism and the ability to want to be your own person. And that's why we got the greatest country in the world, because we got all these people that around the world that have come here.
That's right.
You know, trying, inspiring to do that. And it's not a birthright, boys and girls, okay? Some of you are really getting some bad coaching, in my opinion. Your only birthright is you're American. That's it. There's nothing, no other entitlement, in my opinion. That would fall more into the communist way of thinking, would it not, Deborah? Am I missing something?
No, I agree with you. I think people take advantage of being American and don't really reach out there and grab it.
They miss it. This entitlement program, you guys got to stop this stuff. Seriously, I'm telling you. There's nothing but despair and regret in your future if you want to live an entitlement mentality. If you go out and achieve, you're going to feel so much better about yourself,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's absolutely.
It's incredible. So in a free market system, the only way that wealth is created is when someone creates value and then the participants in a free market system vote by buying the created product or service. It is the ultimate in fairness. In other words, free enterprise, supply and demand, innovation. You create a product like Microsoft, you're going to get rich.
That's right.
You're a kid like the kid that came up with Facebook, you're going to get rich. You mm-hmm. know, these kinds of things, innovation, entrepreneurism.
It's funny they say that because a lot of the government's money right now that's going to creating jobs is actually going towards the small entrepreneurships.
Yeah, and that's what we need. That's yes. what's going to drive our country forward. Now we go from 1776, Adam Smith, into 1792, where the New York Stock Exchange was founded, to 1847, where Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. We're going to jump all the way over now, about 50 more years, about 100 years, roughly, over to Benjamin Graham. In 1934, Benjamin Graham wrote the book, Securities Analysis, which was a bestseller and became the stock-picking Bible. Tell us about the book, Deb.
Well, he basically laid the first organized argument, if you will, that for the idea that stock-picking works. But here he ran afoul of the very idea that Adam Smith had created in 1776, that free markets work. What Graham was basically saying is that free markets, setting prices for stocks is wrong. Supply and demand has somehow failed, and really smart people know better what the real prices should be. So by taking advantage of this mispricings of the free market, one can create additional wealth for himself and pass that on to other investors as well. Graham actually sided with Karl Marx by arguing that free markets fail. He went on to say that it is impossible to find where failures in prices pricing occur and take advantage of them.
So really, when you start to look at it, you've got some key academics that have taken the sides of some key, political...
Very political.
...people. That would be Smith and Marx. An early proponent of Smith was Paul Samuelson. Now, Paul Samuelson in 1965 said that price movements are random and unpredictable, that no one can predict what stocks, what they'll do next. And in the other camp is Benjamin Graham, whom we just talked about. If you support Smith's view, you can strategize by owning different asset classes, diversifying and rebalancing your portfolio as needed. If you believe, like Marx did, that markets fail, your strategy will be to pick stock, time the market, and track record invest. So what we're trying to say as we're going through this history, Deb, is that there's a very clear delineation in investing style based on your core belief. Do you believe markets are efficient or inefficient?
Basically, your philosophy.
Your philosophy, right. Now, most people have never been educated about this philosophy.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, Benjamin Graham, interesting here, break's coming up on us. Benjamin Graham, Marx's early proponent, actually recanted in 1976 regarding what he said about stock picking some 40 years earlier. The father of stock picking said, quote, "I am no longer an advocate of elaborate techniques of securities analysis in order to find superior value opportunities. This was rewarding 40 years ago. Today, I doubt whether such extensive efforts will generate sufficient superior performance to justify their cost. I am on the side of the efficient market school of thought," unquote. So here's a guy that really kicked off the whole idea of active management and chasing the market and that type of stuff, who 40 years after he wrote the book that really created that whole gambling process, recanted and said, I was wrong.
And I think he was trying to be nice to himself by saying maybe it had worked 40 years ago, but it doesn't work today.
Yeah, so really, I guess he must have had some kids. And you know what I notice is as you get older, I was a very liberal thinking when I was younger. What's the word? Idealistic?
Yeah.
But once you have kids, it's incredible how conservative you start to get, isn't it?
It sure is.
Especially when they get older.
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left. Let's jump over to 1952. We're going from 1934 over to 1952.
A man by the name of Harry Markowitz identified a statistical scientific way to build diversification into a portfolio, and he called this modern portfolio theory.
This was huge. This guy is a massive brain, okay? In 1952, at the University of Chicago graduate student, he published an article in the Journal of Finance entitled Portfolio Selection. This article laid the foundation for what we know today as modern portfolio theory. Markowitz found that by combining different asset classes in a portfolio, you could consistently increase the rate of return while systematically reducing the volatility. So, very simply, it's the idea of suntan lotion and umbrella companies.
Right.
If you own umbrella companies unto themselves, it could be fairly volatile because it doesn't always rain. If you own suntan lotion companies unto themselves, they are fairly volatile because the sun doesn't always shine. What Markowitz did, and really everyone subscribes to Markowitz, there's no question about this. He is a godfather of modern portfolio theory. He's invented the math that we use. What he realized that was by taking two risky asset classes that had dissimilar price movement, or the technical term is low correlation, that basically you're going to hit whatever's up.
That's right.
So he's subscribing to the idea that the market is efficient, and let's use that efficiency to our advantage by recognizing that we never know what's going to be up, but we want to own everything so that we do own what's up, because overall it is all up.
And really, really what that means is if you own dissimilar price movement type of stocks, that if one stock crashed, they wouldn't all crash.
Exactly. So it's not only dissimilar price movement, but it's sheer diversification.
Right.
Because you never know what's going to be up. For example, in 2009, international was leading. Right now, U.S. large is leading. You never know what it's going to be up from year to year. So you want to own all of it. Well, time's ticking away. Let's move forward real quick to 1960. Well, you know what? Let's not. Because we're going to talk about this guy's a little bit heavy, this Ed Lorenz. He has nothing to do with finance, but he's a very interesting guy. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Paul Nichols, the investor coach, joined by Deb Seward. It's Your Money is brought to you every week by Financial Abundance. Financial Abundance is a registered investment advisory firm here in State College with offices in Lewisburg and San Diego. In fact, we're going to be teaching some courses in May at San Diego University, Deb. So if you know anybody in California, you can send them to our class. We have had tremendous reviews. It's the same course that we do here at South Hills and Susquehanna University and Sun Area Technology Center. And we're getting incredible, incredible reviews. And, you know what? People are tired of getting pitched. They're tired of getting pimped to. They want some meat. You know, they want to see the bone and see the meat on the bone. So that's what we're bringing to the table here. It's Your Money, the show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about money and investing. We'll be right back. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. You're listening to It's Your Money, the syndicated financial radio show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about money and investing. And I'm with Deb Seward this morning, and we are talking about the history of investing. Boy, if you miss the first segment, you're definitely going to want to go to iTunes and download this show or go to our website and listen to it. We reached all the way back to 1776 to start a timeline to talk about the history of investing. And now we're up to 1960, right, Deb? Real quick, as a recap, we talked about Adam Smith, how the Stock Exchange New York was founded in 1792. We talked about Karl Marx and the difference between an efficient viewpoint and a socialist and a free enterprise approach at looking at the market. We talked about Benjamin Graham, who wrote a book called Stock Picking Analysis, that was later recanted in the 70s. We talked about Harry Markowitz, and now we're up to 1960. And let's move forward and talk about a gentleman by the name of Ed Lorenz, who was studying a completely unrelated area of science. Deb, tell us about Mr. Lorenz.
Well, he actually studied weather patterns at MIT, and he thought that he could, by measuring humidity and temperature and wind velocity, that weather could be reliably predicted. In his assumption, you could ignore very small conditions that were largely immeasurable. His findings, small immeasurable inputs created massively different outputs, which is known today as the butterfly effect.
Yeah, and he wrote a paper called The Butterfly Effect. It was entitled, Does a Flap of a Butterfly's Wings in Brazil Set Off a Tornado in Texas? I think they made a movie about this. It was called The Butterfly Effect with, what's that kid's name that married, or is going with Demi Moore? A Kirshner or something, right? Young kid?
Yeah.
Ashton Kirshner, yeah, with Demi Moore. And they say, well, why is he going with such an older woman? Well, look at Demi Moore. I mean, come on, give me a break. This effect explains why it is impossible to forecast with any degree of certainty what will happen to the weather several weeks from now. So, obviously, the weather is a chaotic system, and that's really what we want to get to. That in Lorenz's chaotic system, this is really what this study brought out, was the reason you couldn't measure it is because it's chaotic.
That's right.
Okay? If something is being impacted by random events that we're incapable of controlling or predicting with certainty in advance, like the weather, Lorenz's work had a tremendous impact on how free markets actually function and why free markets need to be random and unpredictable. See, in a free market society, the randomness is an inherent part of the system. Small, immeasurable inputs that are beyond anyone's ability to clearly see can create massive differences in output. So, for example, tell them about Bill Gates. Think about Bill Gates.
Well, if you think about the Bill Gates, when he came up with Microsoft, they call that the guy in the garage effect. You know, kind of like the Beatles, too. I mean, if little things like this, these small initial inputs, which were unpredictable and immeasurable by anyone's ability to think, Look at the massive impact they had.
Oh, my God. You look at Bill Gates. I mean, there's no question. I mean, it was a huge paradigm shift, changed the way we do business, changed everything in our life.
Everything.
And then you think of, who was the other fellow there? The Beatles.
They talked about the Beatles.
Well, geez,
yeah.
My goodness.
I know.
When you think of musicians, you think of Elvis, Beatles. You know, I mean, they come
Everyone
up
tried yeah. to emulate, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So another easy way to relate to this is through the old saying. And I forget where this comes from. And it's going to bug me. I'll figure it out. Someone, if you know where this comes from, it's from a novel, I'm sure. Let us know. For lack of a nail, the shoe was lost. For lack of a shoe, the horse was lost. For lack of a horse, the general was lost. For lack of a general, the battle was lost. And for lack of the battle, the war was lost. All for the lack of a nail. Little teeny-weeny things, I don't even like saying that, teeny-weeny, that sounds, somehow have a tendency or propensity to snowball into things that are completely unpredictable or immeasurable by mankind, and that's what Professor Lorenz found in 1960 when he was trying to find an equation to accurately predict or forecast the weather. So when you start looking now, this is the only guy and the only study that we're talking about that's not necessarily in the financial arena, but it makes a very strong point. We've talked about this. Can, in fact, you predict the market with any degree of certainty or use a deterministic system which has measurable outcomes? Can you use a deterministic system in a chaotic system with any results? And you can't, but
no.
The implication is that you can, and the proof in the pudding is that you can't, because what I mean by that is the active managers are implying that they have some insight the rest of us don't. But when you look at the results, 85% of the managers don't get market returns.
That's right.
It's really scary business. So let's go ahead. What's the next major timeline event?
Well, this was pretty measurable as well. 1964, when Dr. William Sharp found a very simple way of measuring risk and expected return in a portfolio. He called this the beta-Sharpe ratio, or more simply, beta. And this really is just a measurement of risk. And he basically, you know, if you think about the beta, he said beta is, equals one, if you will. One equals the market. And basically, if you had a stock or a fund that you were trying to measure the risk, if it was greater than one, then it was a greater risk. And you would really expect a higher return because of that volatility. And therefore, if there was something that was less volatile, the market, less than one, it should be less risky. And because of that, there should be a lower expected return.
So to hit it from a different angle for more clarity, beta is one, the beta of one is the market.
Correct.
So that the baseline is the market as a whole.
Right.
And if you had a higher beta, 1.5, let's say, then you would have a higher risk
than the market itself.
Than the market as a whole.
Yes.
And if you had a lower, then it would be less.
Correct.
Okay.
And so risk return.
Right. Now, Dr. Sharp would later win the Nobel Prize for this one-dimensional model, along with Markowitz and Merton Miller, for this model of examining risk and return in the market. Even so, there was still significant agreement among investors and financial professionals at the time that the best way to get high returns on investing in stocks in the market was to try to pick the best stocks, as advocated by Benjamin Graham in his stock-picking Bible, if you will.
And that didn't work either.
No. No, and that brings us from 1960. Wasn't it 60 was Sharp? I'm pretty sure it was 60, wasn't it?
1964. Yeah.
Yeah. Then 1 year later, a gentleman who we mentioned earlier briefly, Paul Samuelson, who was an early proponent of Adam Smith, in 1965, he stated that price movements were random and unpredictable. In other words, Samuelson came out with a direct opposition to Benjamin Graham and said, look, buddy, you can't pick them. You can't pick the stocks. And in fact, he goes on to explain why. Go ahead. You want to share that with them?
Yeah, he found that price movements followed a random or unpredictable pattern, and no amount of knowledge about what happened in the past to a stock or to a market could tell you anything meaningful about what the prices were going to be in the future.
We say it all the time. Past performance is not indicative of future
right.
results. Now, there's a reason, ladies and gentlemen, you see that printed everywhere. On your prospectuses, okay?
Disclosure.
Disclosure. And the fact of the matter is, it's making it very clear. What it's basically saying is, don't stock pick and market time, but in fact, that's what the managers are doing.
That's right.
It's really kind of...
No one can predict the future.
It's frustrating when you really... Look, it's like anything else. When you have clarity and as Bill Murray would say, total consciousness. Remember that from Caddyshack? I got that going for me. Remember the Dalai Lama told him when he dies, right before he dies, he'll have total consciousness. And he says, well, I got that going for me. But anyway, when you start to have total consciousness, so to speak, clarity sets in and you start to go, well, why would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started to break down, we're talking about Dr. Samuelson, the idea that we can predict what the market is going to do or that we can predict what an individual stock or a company is going to do. His basic conclusion was that price movements are unpredictable. No one CEO, no large broker-dealer, no economist, no politician, no chairman of the Fed can tell you with any degree of certainty where prices are going next for individual stocks or for the market as a whole. At the same time, Samuelson was saying that price movements are random and unpredictable. The mutual fund industry was evolving. See, this is 1965, we've got to remember, and was growing with fund managers trying to pick stocks. The whole industry had grown up on Wall Street, and leading investors were starting to believe that you could pick stocks because that's what the market was propagating. They were saying if you can pick stocks well or hire a fella or gal that can pick them well, you're going to get wealthy.
That's right.
Okay. But then all of a sudden, everything kind of changed. Because in 1968, a gentleman by the name of Michael Jensen came along. Now, had you heard of Michael Jensen prior to this?
I did not.
And it's really interesting because Mr. Jensen came along. He was with A.G. Beckenkamp. I must have been a financial outfit. And he decided who was right. He wanted to know who was right, the stock pickers or the market believers. And what did he do, Deb?
Well, they wanted to see, again, if active managers could beat the market or whether it was better to own an index fund comprised of the entire market. So they found very conclusively that active managers trying to pick the best stocks do a terrible job as a whole and that they can't consistently beat the market. So Jensen and Beckenkamp started creating things called indexes, what would have happened if investors owned all of the stocks in one market rather than specific stocks. And what they found was brutal for the industry to hear. They found that all these supposedly brilliant stock-picking professionals did miserably and failed to deliver market returns. Not only were they not beating the market, they were losing in the ballpark of about 2 to 3% per year, which is huge. Investors would have done much better if they had just gone out and bought the whole market.
And we talk about this all the time. Almost daily, Deb, when we analyze people's portfolios and we see the fees for active management. Now, Jensen and Beckenkamp wrote papers in many of the financial journals and confronted the active managers and chastised them for saying people would be much better off investing in the market as a whole rather than with them. And ladies and gentlemen, that hasn't changed. We're 50 years later. And nothing's changed. It's exactly what the industry wants to do. The active managers were very quick to point out that investors couldn't do that. You couldn't just go out and buy all the stock. There was no investment vehicle that did that. Well, 5 years later, there was, right? And what was that?
1971, John McGowan, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, McGowan.
He acted on this and created the very first index fund. Instead of trying to beat the market, McGowan convinced his employer, who then was Wells Fargo Bank, to buy 500 of the biggest companies and hold them. Buy and hold strategy. And in doing so, he eliminated all of the stock picking, all of the speculating, and all of the gambling, and all of the buying and selling, which happens on Wall Street every day.
Oh, to huge numbers.
So Wells Fargo eliminated all that. Investors could just own the market portfolio. McGowan's reasoning was based on Jensen and Beckenkamp's results. And since actively trading managers weren't beating the market, investors should be able to own the market.
And that brings us, that was 1971, that brings us, a lot of stuff happened in the 60s and 70s
yep.
here, okay? That brings us to 1973 when my friend Burton Malkiel wrote a landmark book, and I have it on our recommended reading list. It's sitting right in our conference room, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. This guy is another huge brain. He's with the Benheim Center for Research with Princeton. Malkiel reasoned that because prices are random, markets are efficient, markets work, as Adam Smith said, and because markets are random and chaotic, according to chaos theory, that investing in the market can be like a random walk. We should eliminate ideas eliminate ideas like stock picking, market timing, and track record investing from the whole process, because eliminating all speculative and gambling methodologies of investing is one of the primary requirements for being a successful investor. Now, he basically really pulled back the curtain and said, come on, guys, you're really missing it here. Let's take all this science. Let's start to apply it. And he just proved the fact, again, all the science continues to prove it, that the market's efficient. It is not efficient unless we turn into a socialized state. I mean, if we become fascists, which is not going to happen, if we become socialized or communist, hey, fact of the matter is most people can't even tell you the difference between a fascist and a socialist. There's a dramatic difference, okay? But, you know, so people are throwing these words around. A lot of them don't know what they mean. But, you know, it would take a controlled state, a controlled monarchy or dictatorship, in order to say that stock picking, market timing, and track record investing work, because someone would have to control it.
That's right.
It's random. The market's random. It's unpredictable. And that brings us to 1975. Now, in 1975, the first major pension plan committed to the idea of indexing. It eliminated stock picking and market timing. It was the New York Telephone Company, which invested $40 million in the S&P 500 index fund. Then in 1976, Benjamin Graham recanted what he had said about stock picking 40 years earlier. He said, it doesn't work. Even then, he was a little soft on himself when he said that stock picking may have worked 40 years ago, but it doesn't work anymore. I think you were right about that.
Yeah, I alluded to that.
And then, go ahead, what happened a year later?
Well, Robert Ippeson and Rex Singfield created the first completely comprehensive, extensive database on market returns. That was in 1977. They employed graduate students at their universities and had them go through all of the available stocks and fixed income investment data, looking at everything from dividends and stock splits and all the returns as far back as 1926. They wanted to really, really fully compute the returns for stocks, bonds, and T-bills over this long period of time. In fact, I think many of brochures that we use today in charts are done by these gentlemen.
Yeah, you see them all over the place.
Everywhere. Through this process, they started to find relationships on how different asset categories and dimensions of returns performed over long periods. They identified what they called risk premiums. For example, they found that stocks had approximately a 3 to 6% risk premium over fixed income because it was more volatile investment, and investors wouldn't invest in stocks unless it had an expected premium. They found that bonds had a slightly higher rate of return in the ballpark of 1 or 2% compared to T-bills. They started to identify and take a comprehensive look at what markets did and how they reacted over long periods of time.
Yes, so basically Ippeson and Singfield kind of changed the environment. You know what? We got to go to a break already. We're talking about the history of investing. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach, joined by Deb Seward, and we will be right back after the break. Back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. You're listening to It's Your Money, the radio show that pulls back the curtain on the financial industry and exposes the truth about money and investing. We believe that education plus clarity leads to confidence that could result in peace of mind. So you don't need to know everything if you have a coach teaching you the few right things. Now, that coach could be a cooking coach. It could be a fitness coach. It could be a academic coach. It could be an investor coach. It could be your mechanic or your dentist or your plumber. These would all be forms of coaches, would they not?
I
mean, these are people that have expertise in a certain area. And we have worked very hard for many years now in Central PA to brand ourselves as the Investor Coach. And I think we've done a pretty good job. In that our radio show syndicated now, and from the radio show came the NBC News Investor Coach for WJAC Channel 6. From that and iTunes comes people all over the country that have become clients because they want to understand an academic approach. It's like a breath of fresh air, I've been told. And all that has led to San Diego University and all that. So isn't it interesting how, you know, you start out, my intent was to quit pimping, to quit selling, to quit pitching, but to focus on education with the intent that hopefully people will come to the same epiphany or have an epiphany or some come to the same conclusion that I did. And I think in the time that we've been working together, Deb, it's interesting because we first started talking about it, and at first you were considering it, and I think you've come to your own conclusions and have had your own epiphanies, if you will.
After 30 years in the business, working for, you know, big broker houses and wire houses, it's amazing how I felt the same way. I felt there's got to be a way to educate these clients so they can feel comfortable what I'm trying to say to them without having necessarily trust, although trust is a good thing. But I wanted them to know what they were doing and have peace of mind of their own. And honestly, after this downturn in 2008, it really made me feel like Wall Street was really the problem.
It is the problem. There's no question about it.
I saw all these bonuses after people lost.
It's the greed.
Yeah.
It's the greed. It's just too lucrative. And I'll tell you, I've watched people. I've been fortunate enough. I've really been blessed to be around some very unique people. I've met a lot of unique people in my speaking engagements. And I'll tell you what, I've seen people. I don't know if that's proper English. I've watched people obtain a massive amounts of wealth and how it's changed them. And I'm telling you, folks, power corrupts.
Yes.
I've seen it firsthand in more than one occasion. And hey, there was a point in my own career where I started believing my own press clippings, you know? And it's ridiculous because, regardless of your spiritual stance, God has a way of humbling you.
That's
I really
right.
believe that, you know. But we're talking about the history of investing. And if any of you out there feel like you're getting a pitch from somebody, give us a call and let us educate you about what's going on. Get a second opinion. I had a client of mine come in the office yesterday. Had some guy pitching him one of these guaranteed 7% deals, and it's misleading. Oh, yeah, you can put your money in this, and we guarantee you 7%, and you don't get any risk, or you can't lose your money. Your money's guaranteed. They just don't tell them the rest of the story.
That's right.
This client of mine came in the week before and told me this. He said, Paul, why didn't you do this for me? I said, let me look at that. I said, that guy's lying to you. And though you, mister, you're a liar, okay? You advisors out there that are not telling people the whole story, shame on you. You know doggone well what you're doing. For you to imply that somebody's getting a 7% guaranteed ratchet up and not tell them the rest of the story that it's only death guarantees their principal and only if they take an income stream are they guaranteed 7%, and the 7% is not the income stream, that's just the ratchet up. A lot of you guys, shame on you. You should know better. If you got to do that to make a living, I feel sorry for you.
That's right.
You're pitiful. That's how I feel about it. I don't know how if I can be any stronger than that. You can make a lot of money and not have to do that kind of stuff. And I'll tell you, over half the advisors out there don't tell the whole story.
That's right.
And you know damn well who you are, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself. So I'm sorry. I got on a rant there. I just get so fired up because this guy could have made a major mistake over what was not the truth.
That's right.
And in my opinion, Deb, intent is lying.
That's right.
Doesn't matter how you tell the story, mm-hmm. if the intent is in any way to mislead in any way, shape, or form, you're a liar, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself. And you know who I'm talking about out there. You guys know who you're doing it. Why don't you look in the mirror? Ask yourself, would you do that before you pitch it to somebody else? Ask yourself, Mr. Advisor, Mrs. Advisor, ask yourself, would you do that? And if you wouldn't do that, why would you want someone else to do it? Come on. That's ridiculous. Okay. I'm back. Hello. Yes, come in. Okay, we're back on track, Deb. Where are we?
All right, that's right. Well, we just ended in 1977, and we're ready to move on now to 1981, to a Ralph Bantz at the University of Chicago. He identified another dimension of return, and he called it the small company effect. We sort of talked about this a little bit earlier, about how our government likes the entrepreneurship of United States of America and how that's how we've grown over the years.
Innovation is what has always got our country out of a financial mess. It'll get us out of this one as long as the politicians don't get too intrusive.
That's right.
Okay. Rolf Bonds found that if you systematically buy very small companies, there was an expected return or additional rate of return of about 2 or 3% per year for owning that asset category, as opposed to buying very large Fortune 500 companies. In 1981, an outfit made up of a lot of academics called Dimensional Fund Advisors launched the first passively structured market portfolio to capture the small company premium. They took the research by Ralph, coupled with the fact that financial analysis are equally as bad as picking stocks as they are at picking large stocks. In other words, the analysts are just as bad at picking large as they are small stocks.
Right.
So to develop a portfolio that brought all of the small stocks to capture that market rate of return, This was a very small market passive portfolio. So this was really unique,
yes,
Deb, at the time in 1981.
This would be the size of the companies.
Let's recap now just to bring us back to where we are. We started in 1776 with Adam Smith. We talked about the form of the New York Stock Exchange in 1792. We went on to the mid-1850s and talked about Karl Marx when he wrote the Communist Manifesto and compared that to Adam Smith's work in Wealth of Nations. We jumped over to 1934 where Benjamin Graham wrote the Stock Picking Bible, or what was referred to as the Stock Picking Bible. In 1976, he recanted that, by the way. Harry Markowitz, the godfather of modern portfolio theory in 1952. We went on to a study done by Edward Lorenz at MIT about the chaotic effect and weather. Then came William Sharpe in the 60s talking about beta. And then Paul Samuelson talking about random price movements in 65. Also, 65 through 68, we had Michael Jensen and Beckenkamp, who were looking at indexing and the idea of buying the whole market. Later came John McCown, who basically created the first index fund when he worked with Wells Fargo, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And that was the New York,
New York Pension, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, later, it was a New York telephone company, $40 million in the S&P 500. Then Benjamin Graham recants in 76 that stock picking doesn't work. Ibbotson and Ziegfeld developed this massive returns database. And then Banks come on and talks about the small company effect. And that brings us, ladies and gentlemen, to a couple of my economic heroes, if you will. And that is Eugene Fama and Kenneth French. These guys, both big brains at the University of Chicago and Dartmouth, I think it was, yeah, Yale, and the University of Chicago. And it, what they found was that in addition to equity premium and the size premium, in other words, having money in the market, understanding that small companies return more than large companies, but the risk is higher, okay, they also looked at value. And they said there's growth stocks and value stocks. A growth company would be a very stable, large, it couldn't be large, could be small, but a very stable company. A value company would be one that would be considered unexcellent or distressed. And they realized there was a higher rate of return by owning value over growth companies. So what they recognized, basically, is they looked at the premium and they said, is there a risk premium? If you look at the premiums, and what they mean by risk premium is what's the return for taking that risk? The equity premium, the size premium, and the value premium, this provides an extremely high degree of explanatory power for the portfolio. In particular, these three factors explain in excess of 90% of the expected return of a portfolio and the makeup of the three-factor model. Virtually everything that is important to a portfolio's return is encapsulated in the research by Fama and French. See, they went out, Deb, and said, we want to find out where do returns come from and where do we get a premium for taking risk in that area. And this study just revolutionized the industry. And that brings us to 1988. And F.A. Hayek published a book called The Fatal Conceit and won the Nobel Prize for it. Why don't you share that with us, Deb?
Well, he went into great detail about how self-ordered systems are far greater and superior in many instances to human-ordered systems. He talked about economies and how the economy pricing system accumulates vast amounts of data into the pricing system. It became very clear to other economists specializing in stocks how Hayek's work could be incorporated into the free market pricing system.
Now, by the way, he won the Nobel Prize in 1974. I don't know when the book was written, in 1988 is when kind of the science was applied, if
right.
you will. Okay, so he won the Nobel Prize in 1974. This is F.A. Hayek for The Fatal Conceit, and he basically said, look, we got self-ordered systems that are more powerful than human-ordered systems. The market is an information processing mechanism.
Right.
Prices are figured in instantaneously. Bear Stearns... People didn't know about Bear Stearns before the morning Bear Stearns was announced. AIG.
That's right.
Enron. So anyone that has any insight or claims to have any insight to what's going to happen before is guessing. It's a prediction. It's not fact. If it was fact, it would be insider trading.
That's right.
Right? Because they wouldn't know ahead of time. Now, what we want to do then is tie all this together. And in 1990, several of the authors of modern finance were recognized with a Nobel Prize. That would include Dr. William Sharpe, was honored for his capital asset pricing model. Dr. Harry Markowitz was honored for the theory of portfolio choice and diversification. And Dr. Merton Miller was honored for his study of capital structures. All of this built on Adam Smith's view of free markets in 1776. Think about the amount of insight and common sense that man had.
Way back then,
235,
yeah.
40 years ago. To really call what is effectively capitalism and free market capitalism today. And in a market that is the greatest wealth generation tool known to man. There's no question about it. The market is where wealth is created and where wealth is lost. This is why I get so fired up when I got a bunch of advisors out there that are lying to people and misleading them, you know, because these poor people don't know.
They don't know. They're trusting.
Yeah, they're trusting. Ladies and gentlemen, quit trusting. Don't put a dime where you don't fully and thoroughly understand where that money's going.
Educate yourselves properly.
Yeah, please do. And get a second opinion. You know, these guys out there and gals just gets me so fired up. Shame on you. That brings us to where we are today in what we call free market portfolio theory, which is basically utilizing all these studies we've talked about, realizing the market is efficient, modern portfolio, diversification works, low correlation, understanding what your risk is, understanding what your return is, understand the incentives in the industry that will create advisors to be misleading and tricky and lie and deceitful and unconscionable and all those things, because money makes you stupid, okay? Right? Money makes us stupid. I'll tell you, I've broken up fist fights in my office over errors when it's time to split up the money. I just had another story yesterday.
If that part is sad.
A guy was telling me that his wife and their siblings are now fighting over their dead mother's home. Oh, my goodness. You know what? My grandfather, he says, you can have this. You can have this when I die. I said, Patu, I don't want none of it. I don't want anything. You want to give me that clock? That's the only thing I'd want. You keep all that money. You give it to somebody who needs it, okay?
And I think that, you know, take it back to the parents. I think that they don't educate themselves enough either on what the proper way is to disperse of money at times. So because of that, they fail to plan at all. They just sit back and think, oh, it's all going to happen and work out whenever I pass.
In my opinion, the biggest mistake I see, Deb, is parents do not start to talk to their older adult children as they get older.
I agree with that.
And communicate, look, here's where I'm at, here's how I feel about this. And then it's a guessing game afterwards.
I think that some of that has to do with if you didn't grow up with money or you grew up during the Depression era, you didn't really have money to talk about. So that's why you didn't talk about it. And that kind of went on generation after generation.
Well, yeah, it becomes kind of the close lip, tight lip, close to the vest type of thinking. And, hey, communication, when's communication bad?
Never.
I'm not talking about, you know, degrading, you know, comments. And I'm talking about, you know,
life.
Communication.
Yeah.
Communication is not a bad thing. No news is always bad news to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know whether this no news is good news. No, no news is bad news to mm-hmm. me. I want to know what's going on. Well, listen, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that this has enriched your life in some small way. I encourage you to go to the website Financial Abundance, Inc. That's financial. AbundanceINC.com. Download the show after the weekend. Rick will put it on the beginning of next week. The History of Investing. Get educated, ladies and gentlemen. We have a wealth of information on our website. Go to the WJC TV website. There's all kinds of information. I hope this finds you well. It's a beautiful day. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. And you Lion advisors, get it together, brother. Come on. Quit it. Stop it. It's not worth it. Have a great day. Talk to you later.